Hello to our many listeners around the world. It's the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am Neil Pollack, your host and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. This week's episode will just be a series of impressionistic images about my career as a writer and an editor, accompanied by shots of family trauma and various other touching moments from my life. Oh, no, wait, I'm describing the season 3 premiere of The Bear, the hit quote-unquote comedy that is now airing on FX and Hulu and, surprisingly, Disney+. We're going to have Book and Film Globe contributor Greg Ford here to talk about The Bear. He hasn't been on the show for a while, and he's usually talking about The Bear when he is, so it's good to have him back. We also have Stephen Garrett talking about Kinds of Kindness, the new anthology film from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who made Oscar-winning movies like Poor Things and The Favorite. And Stephen will also be here right after this musical interlude to talk about A Quiet Place, Day One, the popular prequel to the Quiet Place movies. Stephen didn't like it much, but people are watching it, so we're talking about it, and we'll be right back after this. Stephen, hello.
Shh, quiet.
I want to talk about A Quiet Place, Day One.
We shouldn't be talking at all. Just don't talk.
All right, well, we have to. We have to. We have a podcast. I guess in the dystopian world of A Quiet Place, there are no podcasts. I don't know if that's such a bad thing.
That's true, actually. Well, no, you can listen to Nina Simone on your iPod, apparently, if you've got headphones.
Yeah, but there's no, I mean, how do you charge your earbuds? You know,
that's a good point. How do you charge anything? Well, it's one of many problems. If you think about this movie too much, it starts to fall apart pretty fast. As with the prequels, or not the prequels, the previous films. This is
the previous films. This is the prequel. Here we are. Prequel mania continues. We're talking about A Quiet Place Day One, which is our movie of the week, and which is quite a big hit, actually. This is one of those franchises, kind of like Saw or Final Destination, that I did not delve into and I never really cared about, but has a lot of loyal fans. Apparently, this movie made $50 million on its opening weekend. Given the box office this summer, that's a blockbuster, and it's A Quiet Place Day One, and it's a prequel to the popular Quiet Place movies, which came out a few years ago. But this has a mostly different cast, right?
Oh, complete. Well, I would say almost entirely a different cast. The pleasant surprise is seeing Jimin Hansu, who plays a character in the second film, in A Quiet Place Part Two. So it's kind of fun to see him and his family in a sort of peripheral way. So that's kind of a nice callback. It's a nice callback. But yeah, otherwise, they've gotten rid of the Abbott family. That was John Krasinski and Emily Blunt and their
children. All right. Well, let me, you didn't like this movie. You gave it a 2-star rating out of 5, which is pretty low for you. You know, you're pretty tolerant of stuff, even sort of genre crap.
I think it's well made. But I have the same problem that I had with the previous two films, which is just it's a silly, misguided premise, fundamentally flawed. But in terms of the way it's made, it's made the best you can make something like this that is not thought out very well. You know, it's a script problem. It's a monster problem.
Right. Our lead character is Lupita Nyong'o, and I'm going to read you this quote. This tweet I sent to you after your review came out. There's a global $60 million horror sci-fi action film where the lead is a gorgeous dark-skinned black woman wearing her natural hair, and the plot is about the depth of her empathy and heroism. Stephen, you didn't point any of that out. I mean, any of that out in your review, and I think that's. I think I'm going to deem you problematic.
I was so myopically focused on the problematic villain, which is a blind. It's almost like Pinball Wizard, right? It's a deaf, dumb, and blind. Maybe it's not like it can hear. That's all it can do. It has all these goddamn ear canals. It's a silly monster. I mean, you think of like the Xenomorph in Alien. That whole franchise, starting with the very first film, is all about the reproductive cycle of this monster and how genius it was created. Its whole biology is fascinating and integral to the story. This is like peripherally it's relevant only in that if they hear a noise, they jump on it immediately. And they seem to come out of nowhere to do it, but it's arbitrary as to which noises set them off and which don't. Except for the fact that if there's a constant noise, then it becomes kind of background noise, like white noise, they're okay with. But if you do anything else.
So like a generator, they like it. They're fine with the leaf blower?
They're fine with leaves blowing, you know, the wind blowing through leaves. They're fine with a steady stream or something like that. But like a big generator noise freaks them out. That becomes a plot point here.
So here's the deal. They're these aliens, right? They're not hungry. I mean, what are they eating? Are they just like eating tuna, canned tuna? I mean, they're not.
No idea.
They're not hungry. They're not power hungry. So really, they're just like me at the movies trying to get people to shush.
That's basically it. Except you have superpowers where you can leap suddenly and quickly onto somebody and then rip them apart. But you don't eat them. You don't eat them. What they eat is, there's a scene in this movie, and I don't recall the other two movies having any explanation of what they eat or how or why. Again, in the first movie on a whiteboard, you see a note saying, they don't eat their prey, or you know, something like that. Like nobody, look, a lot of things to address. First of all, I think Lupita Nyong'o is an incredible talent and is stunningly beautiful and is a great actor. And she does, as does everybody else in this movie, as do everyone else in all the other movies, they do their best with what they're given. And what they're given is, if you make a noise, this crazy monster is going to pop out of somewhere and get you. Not going to eat you, it's just going to get you. So it's like a boogeyman thing. It's basically a boogeyman thing, right? That said, they weave a story around her. She's dying of cancer. She wants to go up to Harlem. She walks from Chinatown to get a slice of pizza at Patsy's.
She wants to get a slice of Patsy's pizza? Isn't Patsy's pizza in Brooklyn?
Patsy's pizza, there is a location in Harlem, and there's one in kind of like Midtown, I think. There might be one in Brooklyn, too. But the gist of it is, and it's slowly revealed, that she and her dad would get a slice of pizza at Patsy's. Her dad was a jazz musician. He played at a jazz club nearby. And she just wants that, like that sensory experience one more time. And she knows that Patsy's is probably completely empty and there's no fresh pizza. But she's like, I bet there's a slice of cold pizza up there. I want to eat it before it goes completely moldy.
I mean, she better get to it fast. It's going to go rotten.
She gets her pretty fast, I got to say. Look, hey, you know, if you think about it, nothing makes sense in this movie. How many people are on the island of Manhattan? Like a million people? Like how, you know, they only show at most, they show maybe a dozen of these monsters. Seriously, these monsters like wipe out a million people? Or do they flee the city? And if they flee the city, they're in cars, which means the monsters probably jump on the cars too. Like there's so many plot holes, it doesn't make any sense. It looks like a September 11th type attack happens when the asteroids hit the city. And a few of them hit the city and then these monsters spring out. Also, these monsters are riding asteroids onto Earth. Like, okay, fine. Maybe you're just going to roll with it. You just got to roll with a lot of stuff. It's a vibe movie.
Maybe they live in the asteroids.
I don't know. I read some Wikipedia page or Monsterpedia page that explained that they come from a world that has really dense gravity. And so they don't have any sight and the world exploded. And they all, like, I guess, survived on asteroids that then land on the Earth. And now they're just trying to, like you're saying, they're trying to shush everybody in the movie theater because I guess they're just happiest when it's quiet.
Maybe they just want Patsy's pizza.
I did after I saw this movie. I wanted Patsy's pizza. Look,
well, you can get it. You live in New York. Or for me, it's a lot of work.
I mean, the thing is, here's an interesting twist. Okay, so you are surrounded by monsters that are going to kill you, but you have a terminal illness and you should have died already. She even says, like, somebody said, do you want to come into the city? When was the last time you visited? And she said, the last time I went there was supposed to be the last time. So you know she's close to death. So if you're close to death, suddenly you can be quite heroic or just not care so much about dying if you're walking the length of Manhattan to get some pizza. You know, so bravery or nihilism. I don't know.
I will say I can relate. I can't relate. I have walked the length of Manhattan for a meal before. It has happened. I mean, I think we've all done that when we were younger. I don't think I would. I think now I would just hop in an Uber. But, you know, when I was in my 20s, my teens, I would walk a long way for a good meal in Manhattan. So it's relatable. It's relatable. But I guess, so all right. So obviously you do find Lupita Nyong'o beautiful. So
she's very talented and she's quite moving in the way that she traces the arc of her character and fleshes it out. And she meets this clingy, nervous British guy who has a couple opportunities to show feats of nobility and bravery, as do all the characters in each of the movies, because there's fundamentally, this is a boogeyman movie, and the only thing that makes it interesting are the characters who exhibit moments of noble sacrifice at certain times that make you feel good about humanity. There's a line in the first movie where Emily Blunt basically says to her husband, "You've got to protect our kids. If we don't protect our kids, who are we? Like, what are we?" You know what I mean? And I think, you know, that is the through line of all these movies. Humanity is always going to trump, I guess, aliens who are super sensitive to sound and want to destroy anything that moves. I guess. I don't know. It's a boogeyman movie. It's a vibe movie. People like going to scary vibe movies and they like jump scares. And that's all this is. And that's all the other two movies are. I guess I'm struggling to figure out why people like this dumb movie, because it's pretty dumb.
All right. Stephen Garrett endured I guess it was kind of a noisy movie. I mean, the aliens themselves are kind of noisy when they jump around, which is another irony.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't they attack each other, right? You know, anyway, yeah. Whatever. Rabbit hole.
Yeah, rabbit hole. Quiet Place Day One is quietly and noisily in theaters now, and people like it. Not Stephen, who has obviously some biases against a strong black female characters.
But you know what? If you want to see a strong black female character, well acted, and you want to support your local movie theater, buy 5 tickets to this movie. Go take your neighborhood to the movie
theater. Too late. You're too late. You're too late, Stephen. All right. I want you to do a hangout in our waiting room for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll be back to talk about Yorgos Lanthimos's Kinds of Kindness.
Feel good?
We're going to see. Tickets good?
Check. Sharpie.
Check.
More left. Stop. Now just slowly move it back to the right. Save it for later.
All right, we're open.
Doors!
One of the most anticipated TV premieres of the summer has happened. Season 3 of The Bear is out now on Hulu. And it's also weirdly available on Disney Plus, because Disney Plus is now featuring Hulu content as well. And this is sort of an R-rated Disney show in a lot of ways. Season 3 of The Bear, and Greg Ford wrote about it for us on Book and Film Globe. And he did a great job just absolutely eviscerating how terrible this show is. And Greg is here to talk to me about it. Hello.
Hi, Neil.
You've been kind of a Bear hater from the beginning. You know, you're Chicago born and bred.
Yes.
We met in Chicago. I lived in Chicago for a long time. So your main beef, so to speak, with The Bear is that it's a fake Chicago show.
That has a lot to do with it. I forget which episode it was in the second season where I found it so galling that they had to play that Sufjan Stevens song, Chicago, through the opening sequence because, what, they had to drive home that we're in Chicago and they're, you know, filming under the L and here's a restaurant and here's another, I don't know, another hot dog joint and all these iconic shots of skyscrapers. And it just overdoes it because when it gets right down to it, it just doesn't actually feel like we're really in Chicago. It could be, I don't know, anywhere. It could be L.A. It feels more like Los Angeles to me.
Well, and you haven't seen, you only saw the first episode of the second season. I did watch the second one. And after, a cute little cold open with Sydney and her father, there's a long opening credit sequence where it just kind of goes through Chicago and shows a bunch of smiling people making sausages, cleaning hotels, working class people waving at the camera, the people who have been nice enough to stop by their place of work to film them doing their regular person things. And so that's part of the problem with The Bear is it purports to be a show about regular people doing regular people things. But in reality, it is just, it's a very elite product that is extremely high on its own supply. So let's talk about this opening episode of season 3, which you and I both agreed on it immediately, that it's one of the worst things ever put on television.
Yes, really. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it hops all over the place. It opens, correct me, it opens with Carmen, our hero, I suppose, going into their new restaurant, and he's straightening chairs, he's straightening, I don't know, a spoon.
Cleaning up garbage from the nights before service. That seems like a reasonable way to start, right?
Yeah, I mean, and then you think, okay, we're going to get a show about a restaurant because it's a show about a restaurant. But no, we get the story of his miserable life in multiple flashbacks all over, completely out of sequence. All the times he's had bad things happen to him, whether it's a mean chef saying mean things to him about the dish he's maybe not getting quite right, or good memories of the girl he just dumped, and flashbacks to Jamie Lee Curtis's enraged
meltdown.
In that Feast of the Seven Fishes Christmas dinner episode where she drives her car into the house in a rage. But it doesn't add up to anything except the show wants you to feel bad for him for God knows what reason. And it's like
liner notes for the previous two seasons. We haven't seen a lot of those specific scenes before. We've seen all those characters before, all those situations. We know all that stuff. And those people who, you know, I was already on the fence about The Bear. I know that you fell off the fence early, but like, you know, people who like the show, they wanted to see what happens next. What happens next after the family's Italian beef restaurant turns into a fine dining restaurant? What happens to the characters that the show has built up and the relationships that the show has built up, the sort of tension the show has built up? What happens next? And, you know, yeah, we're eventually going to get that during the course of the season. But instead, what we get is a moody tone poem set to a Nine Inch Nails song that just kind of touches on all the themes of the previous two seasons. And, who is this for? Imagine if you had not seen The Bear at all, and this was your first exposure, you would turn it off immediately.
No, you wouldn't make it through. You wouldn't make it anywhere. I mean, I compared it in what I wrote for you to poor man's David Lynch, and I kept thinking about it. Well, I mean, there's that part in Mulholland Drive where the Naomi Watts character suffers some sort of a psychotic break and the whole film changes and everything that was good turns dark. And it kind of felt like something like that, where it's just all of a sudden we're in this hellscape that is the inside of Carmi's head. And why do we want to be there?
Right. Well, and the thing, we ran a piece about The Bear. We've run a lot of pieces about The Bear because it's the kind of show that people talk about a lot. It's the kind of show that people who talk a lot about shows talk a lot about anyway. And
yes.
Right? And, you know, it was like, yes, The Bear is a comedy. And you can't make that argument after watching that episode. This is a show that takes itself so seriously and that is just so high on the awards and the adulation and the press that I feel like Christopher Storr, who's the show's creator, just decided, you know what, I can do whatever I want. I can break all the rules of narrative storytelling and of entertaining television and just drop this pretentious bomb on my audience. And you know what? He didn't really get away with it. I mean, yes, there were some people in the sort of internet reaction zone who thought it was a, you know, brilliant and tear-jerking work of art. But then I saw someone who's, you know, a cultural critic on Twitter whose opinions I generally trust. You know, she said, you know, she just cracked up laughing the third time his sister said goodbye to him at the airport.
Right. I mean, and it's arrogant is what it is.
Yes. Yes. Right. Because really, at the end of the day, The Bear is a sitcom about a bunch of dysfunctional people starting a restaurant. And a good sitcom, let's say like something like Cheers. I know this isn't Cheers. We're past that era of eight hacky 80s sitcoms. But, you know, what you wanted to see when you turned into Cheers was all your favorite characters sitting around, getting into wacky situations and you know, insulting one another. And that's what you want out of The Bear, too. You want restaurant. The best parts of The Bear is when stuff blows up in the kitchen or things fall down or people yell at each other and, you know, then make up and then they yell at each other again. Not this, like, teary melodrama about fine dining.
No, at this point, the best this show could hope to be would be something like the UK's version of The Office, where everybody is unpleasant. There may be a couple of redeemable characters, but somehow you actually feel for them. And it actually ends up being funny.
But instead, it's more like the American version of The Office, where it's turned into this over-sentimentalized vision of its originally cynically conceived characters. Or let's say even, or like Ted Lasso, you know, which is another show that everybody who loves talking about TV loved to talk about, and initially was sort of felt a bit fresh and entertaining, and just gradually like disappeared up its own butt, yeah. You know, and this is, I think, but even Ted Lasso at least never really forgot what its roots were. Whereas I feel like The Bear, you know, it's just like it's so pretentious. That's what gets me.
It's definitely going to bait and switch on us. Because the first season was something else entirely. But then, I mean, it completely lost me second season with that Feast of the Seven Fishes episode. And I haven't recovered. And I think the show itself has not recovered. I think once it went that far, it just decided the showrunner, what's his name, Storer?
Christopher Storer. Became a show about trauma. It became a show about trauma as opposed to a comedy about a restaurant.
Or even, I mean, you can do a comedy about somebody who's had a hard life.
Well, like I think of that Ricky Gervais show on Netflix, the one where he's the guy who's mourning his wife dying.
Yes.
That afterlife. You know, that show, I got tired of it after a while because really, like, you can only have so much Ricky Gervais in your life. But I thought that, like, that show always stayed funny, you know, and never, it certainly didn't get all flashbacky on us. And that's the thing about The Bear is it's so, how we get it. We get it. We get the grief. We understand. We know, we've seen this all before. Just keep moving the story forward and, you know, show us what kind of crazy situations people who are trying to operate a fine dining restaurant get into. You know, and I personally, like, I like Iowa Edebiri, but I find her performance is, like, very annoying. You know, it's like everything's like these half sentences. Everyone speaks in half sentences. Jeremy Allen White speaks in half sentences. The only person who I feel, like, still has the original energy of the show is Ebon Moss Bacharach, who plays Richie.
Yes.
He is relentlessly awesome in this show.
Like I said, in my first piece about The Bear, I don't buy his Chicago accent, but I actually, I agree. I find him immensely watchable.
He has a lot of energy. He has energy. He's entertaining. And his story arc is genuinely interesting.
Yes.
As opposed to Carmi's Moby bullshit. And, you know, Sydney is pretty... Is also fairly flat. You know, they're some of the side characters are fine. I like the pastry chef who's grieving and the Latino woman who's like kind of becoming more of a fine dining chef from being like a working class grunt. All that's fine, but it's just not funny. It's not funny and it's too full of itself.
Yeah, there's that one I did actually watch a couple more episodes after that first one. There was the one thing I thought was funny where that tattooed guy
took the Maddie Math and Neil. His name is Neil.
Yeah.
Great name for a character, I think.
Perfect. He brought the soup dish out to the diners, poured it in front of them, and brought it back rather than leaving it.
Right.
He was following Carmi's instructions very literally. And they didn't get to eat it. That was the only funny thing so far in the season that I've seen. And like you said, you know, this is no longer a comedy. They're not even trying.
Exactly. Well, they're trying. Oh, boy. They're trying to win Emmys is what they're trying to do.
Right.
Well, you can count on Book and Film Globe to offer counterintuitive takes on The Bear. Although I have to say, I almost decided to start liking it again when I saw that Slate offered a similar take to yours. Not as well written and too long, but similar. So clearly, the people the cognoscenti have turned on The Bear, and maybe it'll wake someone up. I probably won't.
Probably.
Maybe it will.
Probably not.
All right. Well, I'm going to go eat a very boring and generically prepared lunch, flashback free. And Greg, I will talk to you soon. Thanks for writing a terrific piece for us.
All right. Thanks, Neil. Take care.
Just tell me what you want. I'll do whatever you tell me. Ask me for anything else you want, and I'll do it.
You must put on a few pounds. Skinny men are the most ridiculous thing there is.
Do my nails, cut my hair, I'm a brand new.
Go.
Our art film of the week is Kinds of Kindness, a new movie from Yorgos Lanthimos, who directed last year's Oscar-nominated, I believe, Oscar-winning.
Oscar-winning
movie, Poor Things. Kinds of Kindness is, I mean, Poor Things was a very strange mainstream movie. Kinds of Kindness is not a mainstream movie. This is a very bizarre art film. Essentially, it is a movie. This one I have seen. Essentially, it is three short stories thematically connected. So it calls to mind sort of indie anthology films of the 90s. And you really see all of Lanthimos's odd perversity on display here. Stephen, you are back. Stephen Garrett.
Hello.
You reviewed Kinds of Kindness. I saw Kinds of Kindness yesterday, and I bought into the premise. I loved the fact that it was the same cast in all three of the stories, with a few modest adjustments. The main actors are all doing very different things in each segment, and I don't know. I found this movie extremely entertaining. Messaging you about it, I sort of refer to it as like a sci-fi Chekhov or something along those lines. I don't know if Chekhov is the right short story master to compare it to, but these all do play out like very finely honed, well-crafted short stories full of irony and twists and surprises.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that's the, it's funny that you mentioned the cast thing too. It's one thing to write about. It's another thing to actually experience it, watch it, and just see the same actors come back in very different roles. And they play off of each other, in your head as you experience the second and then third story and you see them again and again. And it's funny because it is a way of sucking you in, but also keeping a certain distance in the story because you're like, oh, it's that same act. It keeps reminding you of the actors as actors acting a part. Because you're seeing them in suddenly a different role.
But they are terrific. They are terrific.
And they're all terrific. Yeah.
Terrific. Like, I mean, what a cast. I mean, you have Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons, I would say, are your main two stars. But then you have Willem Dafoe. And in smaller roles, you have Hong Chau and Margaret Qualley. All of these actors are just so good.
They're so good. But that's the thing. He keeps reminding you that they are actors and we are watching a story. And I think that's part of that device of reusing the actors. At no point does this feel naturalistic, I guess is my point, right? Because you are constantly being reminded this is absurd.
It's like theater. It's like a short story anthology. It's like theater. The dialogue is, I wouldn't call it unrealistic, but it's a bit stilted the way they deliver it. deliberately so, because and the situations are extremely bizarre. So let's talk about these sort of one at a time. In your review, you mentioned that your favorite was the first segment, and I would have to agree. The first segment involves Jesse Plemons as a sort of a office worker. I think these all take place in Louisiana or New Orleans or someplace like that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. They do. Yeah.
But he's an office worker, very successful. We don't really find out what he does. It's a real estate development of some kind. And he's completely manipulated and controlled by his boss, played by Willem Dafoe, who scripts out his entire day for him, scripts out his entire life for him. And he's sort of he's like his gimp.
Right. He's willingly manipulated. He welcomes it. Until this story, the story we're watching is the moment when he decides to push back and not be manipulated anymore. And then there's the fallout from that decision, right?
Right. And the fallout, it goes about as poorly for him as you'd expect. And watching him sort of come into some sort of self-awareness and decline is, I found it very gratifying and in a sense, narratively gratifying. I wasn't happy that this man was declining, but it worked as a narrative. It was like a Kafka story,
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, all these stories, of course, the title is ironic and, these are really kind of variations on cruelty, and how we influence other people, how we manipulate other people, how we try to control other people, how other people are controlling us, our perception of the world. You know, it's a bit of a mind fuck, you know, each of these movies in their own way. And in the middle story, one of the characters literally calls it out because he feels like he's just being completely played with and toyed with mentally. And I think it reflects on our maybe anxiety or unease about just living in the world as a normal person. You know, what is normal? You know,
well, certainly not this movie. And so each segment gets progressively more violent and perverse. You know, the second one involves there's some group sex, there's cannibalism,
right?
The third one involves literally raising the dead.
Literally raising the dead. Somebody gets roofied. You know, there's a rape in it.
There's a sex cult. There's a very, very bizarre, disturbing behavior. You know, and it's all the acting is done in this sort of flat monotone. And only occasionally, like, does Emma Stone, you know, break out and emote. But boy, she is just tremendous in this. And there's a scene toward the end where, you know, it's always fun. They show this before every Emma Stone movie at the Alamo Drafthouse, where I watch most of my movies. There's a montage of Emma Stone dancing. And she,
in all of her movies?
Not in all. She doesn't dance in all of her movies, but she does in movies, TV. She's been in a bunch of music videos. She danced. She's a great dancer. And so there's a scene of her at the end dancing. Also, there's something at the end of the second segment that you mentioned. There's a montage.
Oh my God, so good. Don't ruin it.
There's a montage to a song that is just so, I was just howling with laughter.
Right? I mean, it's like chef's kiss. Like, you don't see it coming, but it also is so amazing. And I'm so grateful that they did it. Like, what?
So great.
So good.
I don't want to, you know, that's the thing. You can't really talk about this movie that much because you don't want to spoil the twists and the bizarreness of it all. Look, this is not going to be a sort of minor pop culture phenomenon like Poor Things. This is not going to achieve any kind of, this is not a movie for, this is a Criterion Collection movie.
This is. I mean, it's certainly more, talking about Yorgos's other movies, it's more like The Lobster than it is like The Favorite. You know, Poor Things, which is a real breakthrough, but it's more like Dogtooth or The Lobster, one of his weirder movies where you're just like, what? You know, there's a really strong premise, but it's so odd that it's hilarious and wonderful and touching and sad, but also not necessarily for everybody.
Yeah, I consider this movie to be, this is a lot like this is sort of a short story version of The Lobster because there's sex humor. There's violence. There's animal humor. He seems to like all that stuff. There's a lot of naked lady in this movie. A ton of naked lady. There's a lot of, I guess, whatever Yorgos does and says, Emma Stone doesn't mind taking it all off for him.
She is fearless. She certainly is fearless, yeah.
And Margaret Qualley as well, you know, legs up to her neck. You know, doesn't mind it either. So he's got some Euro thing going on where women are.
You're being a little sexist and ageist because Willem Dafoe gets just as buff.
Willem Dafoe is also extremely naked in this. Yeah, my wife, my wife didn't see this one with me. When I told her about it, she's like, well, are there any men naked? I was like, well, Willem Dafoe gets naked. And then she was like, okay.
Okay, I'm interested. I'm listening.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, people, there's a certain kind of person who wants to see Willem Dafoe naked.
No, it's just a joy, right? It's just a joy seeing, even, you know, my reservations about it maybe kind of petering out by the end or losing a bit of focus. It's just that first one is so sharp. It's like a diamond. And the other two don't quite share the same sort of rigor.
Well, the second one, the twist was a little hard to understand, yeah. and the third one is just I like the ending. It goes on a little long. This thing is, you know, this is a solid 2.5 hours at the movies.
Exactly.
And the thing is, though, if you were not in the theater, if you were just watching it on the Criterion channel, which is where you're going to eventually find this or whatever streaming service, you could sort of snack on it, kind of like those Wes Anderson Roald Dahl stories that came out on Netflix. You don't need to watch. You can watch them one at a time. And they're satisfying as a whole, but they're, I think, really good as short stories.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of great movie.
Kind of great movie, I would agree. And Steven and I will be back next week playing different versions of ourselves.
As always. I don't know if it'll be as perverse. I might be naked, but you'll know.
Well, no one will ever know. It's a podcast. All right, Steven Garrett, I will talk to you soon.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, thank you so much, Steven. In three parts, we conducted that interview and we thematically all melded together into a conversation about Kinds of Kindness, the new film from Yorgos Lanthimos, which is now in theaters and will soon be on some sort of indie streaming service. We also talked about A Quiet Place Day One, a much more mainstream film. Stephen, thank you as always for going to the movies and talking to me about them. And thanks to Greg Ford for enduring some episodes of Season 3 of The Bear, which is now airing on FX, Hulu, Disney+, your phone, your tablet, wherever you watch things. If you like The Bear, well, you know, it's your, I guess it's your funeral. It's your argument to have with yourself and your loved ones. I am not a fan of this show anymore, but that isn't stopping people from watching it and talking about it. I am Neil Pollack. I am your chef. I am your host. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more, and I will talk at you next week.
Original production.